Did you know a 2018 study showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual. When I was 4 months pregnant, I couldn't find a prenatal I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested for heavy metals, and recently earned the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. But don't just take my word for it. Get 25% off at ritual.com/podcast. Have you heard about the 2018 study that showed half of prenatal vitamins tested had unacceptable levels of heavy metals? No? Well, now you have. I'm Kat, mother of three and founder of Ritual, the company making traceability the new standard in the supplement industry. I remember staring at my prenatal vitamins and finding all these things I was trying to avoid: high amounts of heavy metals, synthetic colorants, and unnecessary ingredients. So, at 4 months pregnant, I quit my job and started Ritual because I believe that all women deserve to know what they're putting in their bodies and why. I'm so proud of our prenatal vitamin. The ingredients are 100% traceable. It's third-party tested for microbes and heavy metals and recently received the Purity Award from the Clean Label Project. You see, we trace like a mother because, let's be honest, no one cares quite like a mother. But don't just take my word for it. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Not for lack of trying. All right. We're here with Mr. Jay Dyer. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no doubt. I've been wanting to have you on for a couple of years, actually. And it took me a while to figure out. I was like, I don't want to waste this time because I know you're a busy guy and you're popular and everybody's calling you trying to get you on. And so I was like, I want to find the right subject for Jay. And I heard you on Courtney Turner's podcast with James Lindsay.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, that's the one, because my buddy Buck told me to start reading Voglin. So I was like, yeah, Gnosticism. That's what we're talking about. So that's what made me contact you. Give us a little bit of the history of Gnosticism, because the way I look at like what's happening around us in modern society, it seems that there's this real Gnostic kind of point of view that's running through the middle of everything, even if that's not what they call themselves.
Yeah, so Gnosticism, as you probably know, comes from the early Christian era, when you had a lot of groups, a lot of sects that kind of wanted to do their own thing. And they were influenced quite a bit by Greek philosophy, Hellenic thought, as well as Far Eastern thought. So we see already in the early days of the church, kind of the beginning struggle with this. Paul warns about not giving heed to those who profess to have gnosis falsely so-called, or knowledge falsely so-called. So even in the time of Paul, it was kind of becoming a problem. And then as we get into about the 180s, St. Irenaeus of Lyon writes his famous Against Heresies. And about the first 300 pages of that book deals with a myriad of Gnostic sects, groups, people with all kinds of different more ascetic leaning versions of Gnosticism, all the way over to more lascivious sort of orgiastic versions of Gnosticism. So it was kind of all over the place. And while Gnosticism in the early church kind of dies out, the ideological strands of both Neoplatonic and Gnostic thought continue up into the Middle Ages. They kind of experience a rebirth with the Renaissance, people that left Byzantium, like Pleithon, or his ideas that left Byzantium, I should say, that went on to influence a lot of the Enlightenment hermeticists and Enlightenment alchemists. So we get Rosicrucianism that comes out of this in Germany. A lot of the second generation Lutheran theologians were also, according to Dame Frances Yates, into Rosicrucianism. And Rosicrucianism was sort of a vehicle for this, as were a lot of Masonic lodges. They became vehicles for speculative Masonry, which dabbled in Gnostic elements. And modern scientism, in my view, kind of comes out of this idea. So scientism is a variant, I guess you could say, of Gnostic thought, Hermetic thought. Hegel is a variant of Gnostic and Hermetic thought. He was involved in some of the lodges, the Hermetic lodges of his time, that were trying to reproduce the Neoplatonic heritage or the Gnostic alchemical heritage. And these things might be in certain areas in contrast with one another. For example, Plotinus wrote against Gnosticism, but they only disagreed in certain areas. For example, one of those was whether this world was inherently evil or whether it was just a lower metaphysical status from the higher realms. So there are some disagreements between some of these esoteric sects and groups. But the basic ideas of a flight from the temporal world, transcending into some other domain or reincarnation, or the primacy of spirit, the spirit over against matter, this evolutionary process of Hegel's philosophy that everything is evolving into being pure spirit. I mean, all of these are part and parcel with Gnosticism in varying degrees. And, you know, ultimately, it's a misdiagnosis of human problems and human anthropology to think that rather than it's man's heart and repentance that is what he needs, it's merely a lack of knowledge. And so it's a kind of a Pelagian idea that it was inherited by some of these people from the Greek philosophers, right? A lot of Greek philosophy said that no man knowingly does wrong. So man's problem is a lack of knowledge. But of course, that's not man's problem. Man's problem is rooted in his heart and his noose and his lack of repentance. So it's a very different approach to anthropology and attaining, you know, mystical insights and apotheosis through rituals or perhaps just through contemplation or through nowadays, even something like technology and transhumanism being the path to immortality.
One of the things that I kind of gathered from it is this idea that the elites are granted special knowledge. And when I look at like the kind of like social engineering or the managerial movement that has taken place here in the West, I really see kind of a Gnostic element. And what really struck me was, I've been doing a podcast for my paid subscribers called ESG This Week, where I'm like covering the topics of ESG. And we started reading through an essay on the principle of population by Thomas Malthus. And the first thing I realized, recognized was kind of like this intertwining Gnostic element within his writing and the way he thinks about his ability to observe things that nobody else can see and how it's evolved. And even people of modern times hold on to this Malthusian ideal, even though it's basically been proven wrong in almost every facet.
Yeah. He said, I can look at a jar of flies and extrapolate from that, there's going to be limited resources and we won't be able to feed everybody. So therefore we should control the population at the present. And that just goes back to Plato's models of population control, Plato's versions and models of eugenics, which is, you know, ethnic hygiene, racial hygiene, these kinds of things that the British Empire had sort of adopted wholesale. Again, I think ultimately through a lot of these sort of Gnostic and esoteric tendencies in British Freemasonry, British secret societies, they were very enamored with a lot of this stuff. And you can see this reflected, for example, in Edmund Spenser's Fairy Queen, which is supposed to be the Elizabethan narrative of the British Empire, comparable to Virgil's Aeneid. And so that mythology is just projecting this idea of a future utopian society. You get this with Bacon's New Atlantis, this kind of stuff based around science and scientism. So all of the original proponents of scientism, as we said, were directly involved in various hermetic studies, alchemy studies, and lodges. You know, we see this influence even in Descartes. We can see it in probably Leibniz. We can see it in John. I don't know if Locke was a deist, but he was connected to the British East India Company. And in the case of Galileo, he seems to have had a very adept interest in a lot of alchemical hermetic ideas. And I'm not saying all these people are necessarily bad because of that. That was sort of part of the spirit of that time. Was if you studied science, you'd be studying this kind of stuff. Alchemy wasn't yet fully separated from chemistry. They're kind of joined together. So, but the problem is that you get this resurgence of Neoplatonism, this resurgence of Gnostic ideas in these different schools and hermetic groups. And I think you're absolutely right that when we come all the way up to now, the Malthusian ethos is no different. It's still there, still totally enforced. It is what underlies the totality of the technocratic, you know, global agenda today with World Economic Forum, Davos, all these groups. They're essentially motivated by that Malthusian idea, as well as other ideas, right? Other ideas. And I think you're right to take it back absolutely to Gnosticism 100%.
I was one of the things that struck me as kind of odd is talking to Courtney Turner, talking to Monica Perez, they would continue to bring up Fabianism to me. And it never registered the importance of Fabianism.
Yeah, me neither until recently.
Right. Yeah. And I started reading as I've like dived deeper into ESG, I've become more like enthralled with the Fabian ideals. How does Gnosticism kind of tie into Fabianism, and what is the link between Fabianism and modern times? I can't quite find how it found its roots in modern progressive ideals through like Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, so Fabianism is a generation after Marx and Engels, and they saw the failures in classical Marxism. And some of those failures were that, you know, Marx had predicted this uprising of the proletariat, that the workers would, you know, bring about the revolution. That never happened. And so the Fabians just sort of saw the impracticalities in some of the you know, scholastic versions of Marxism and in the theories that they had. And so they wanted to modify, they called it originally reformed Marxism. And Engels at first was not a fan of it, but then he warmed up to it. And it was basically the idea that rather than seeing monopoly capital as the enemy, alliances could be made with monopoly capital and Marxism. And so this becomes reformed Marxism. I think George Bernard Shaw is the first one to use that terminology. But it attracted the attention of some of the most wealthy, powerful people, particularly in the UK, part of the Royal Society establishment, and no less than Lord Rothschild and Cecil Rhodes, Lord Milner, Lord Curtis, Lord Lothian. A whole bunch of these people in the British elite structure became enamored with this idea, as well as the thinker John Ruskin, to first bring the British, the American Empire back under the sway of the British. So they had these original dreams of kind of a grandiose resurgence of the British Empire as that great civilizing force to the whole world. So that, you know, go back to Kipling and these kinds of things. That's the ethos of the British Empire. And so Cecil Rhodes wanted to set up a model for doing this based around the British East India Company model. And so he formed the South African Company, BSAC, British South Africa Company, model on the British East India Company. And he wanted to use the corporate model of control of the British East India Company, not just for the monopoly of the diamond mining in Africa, the De Beers Empire, but also as a strategy and a technique for governance throughout the entire British Empire, done in a shadow government way. So the idea was to take elements of Jesuitism, elements of Freemasonry, and Rhodes created what he called the Society of the Elect. And this was a top core group of people, including himself, Lord Rothschild, and a bunch of the other elites, as well as elements of the monarchy, the British monarchy is too. And the idea would be to foster this ideology, see if they could get America to come back. That didn't really work. And so the Fabians put out and created all of these modern institutions that we know about today, explicitly on record. So League of Nations was a Fabian creation, and that was through the machinations of Colonel Edwin Mandel House working for the Rothschild and the British, the Bank of England and so forth, to get Woodrow Wilson into promoting the notion of the four freedoms, the a new global system of governance. But the League of Nations ended up failing. And so the Fabians came back with a new style of how to do this based on what they call steering committee models. So they took the model of the round table group the Royal Institute for International Affairs, and then they created Chatham House in the UK, which is a secret inner kind of intellectual elite. And then they made a mirror of that in New York called Pratt House. And that's where we get the Council on Foreign Relations and this inner secret policy group that's semi-secret. They're also public, that is above government. And so they give policy to government. And that's been the case since the 1920s, since the CFR came about at the behest of the Rockefeller family, who aligned themselves with these interests that I'm speaking of in terms of the elites in the UK. Of course, the classic text on this that we lectured through is from the promoters of this establishment. It's Carol Quigley's Tragedy and Hope, 1300 pages. He's Bill Clinton's mentor. He's writing from the archives of the CFR. So this is not a conspiracy theory text. This is a real history of the 20th century from these people. And so long story short, the Fabians after World War I reorganized and basically spat out all of these institutions that we now know of as the IMF, the World Bank, the United Nations, the Aspen Institute, you name it, the EU, right? I mean, all of these basically come out of Fabian ideologies. For example, John Maynard Keynes, right? I mean, he's basically the mind behind the IMF and World Bank. And he was, you know, again, famous Fabian socialist. So the reason Fabianism matters so much, and we've had, of course, most of the Labour Party, a lot of British prime ministers have been Fabians as well. You know, when we look at Trudeau, when we look at these people, it's all the same ideology. Mm-hmm. And it's again, a way to meld big capitalism with a form of socialism. And that's why it's so effective. And that's why it's so kind of below, under the radar, because people don't really realize that this is kind of the motivating ideology that's out there. I mean, there's a lot of ideologies out there in the world, but this one seems to be the one that is consistently in the background behind these gigantic institutions, including Bilderberg and including the World Economic Forum.
I was going to bring up the World Economic Forum right here, because I was going to ask, do you think that melding of the capitalist system and the socialist system is the reason behind Klaus Schwab and the World Economic Forum pointing to China as the model of the future?
Oh yeah. Absolutely. Yes. They always wanted this synthesis. And again, this gets back to the Gnostic elements in Hegel. You know, the Cold War strategists often spoke of, including Brzezinski, who was one of the architects of a lot of this stuff and the architect of the ending of the Cold War. He spoke of it as a Manichaean dialectic. And a lot of these thinkers proposed, especially people coming out of the CFR, that they needed a synthesis of Eastern Bloc communism and socialism and Marxism with Western big money neoliberal capitalism. And so that synthesis is represented by ideal situations like China. Yeah. And that's why you know China is basically big state capitalism is how their system is run. And you know, Rockefeller has many chapters in his biography and memoirs where he brags and talks about all this. And he himself studied under both von Hayek and Fabian socialist professor Lasky at Harvard. And so that's why you see in David Rockefeller this perfect mixing of monopoly capitalism, because von Hayek in the last chapter of his book, Road to Serfdom, argues for world government. So you can see that in a lot of the ethos of Rockefeller, but you can also see the socialist ethos there as well, because studying under Lasky, David Rockefeller then goes on to write these glowing praises of Mao and Maoism.
Do you think... You've done, and I would suggest anybody go check out your lectures on Tragedy and Hope. That was actually Richard Grove told me about that. He's a friend of mine as well, a friend of yours. I'm glad y'all are working together right now on all the stuff y'all are doing. Oh, he's a great guy. I know he's on vacation right now, but he'll be coming on in March. We'll be doing something. Yeah. And so I'm excited about that. And do you think that when I was reading Antichrist and the Fulfillment of Globalization by G.M. Davis, he was talking a lot about H.G. Wells and the creating a one world religion around scientism. Do you think that is kind of developed, or do you think they're they were already rooted in that ideal as Fabianism was taken off.
Can you say that again? Do I think what now? Do I think that H.G. Wells had already developed?
No. I'm saying, do you think that H.G. Wells was just revealing what they were already trying to do, or was he just evolving and already like a thought process that hadn't gotten there yet with scientism as a religion of the future? Was that a new idea in the 40s, or was that something they had been working
on? No, that was older. So this really has predecessors in theosophy, which I think was a British establishment creation for a kind of new religion. And so that's why you see, you know, early on in the turn of the century, you've got Madame Blavatsky, Alice Bailey, and Annie Besant pushing a open form of Gnosticism, where they really wanted to make the new religion of the new age, the new aeon, something more scientific. So scientism has a lot of overlap and parallel with theosophy. And, you know, they saw themselves as kind of spiritual scientists, the theosophists. So I would say that, and that precede, well, that's kind of, you know, when H.G. Wells is first starting to write at the turn of the century, that's around the time that theosophy is beginning. And it looks to me like theosophy is really this kind of cover for not just in the floating the idea of a new religion and a new age and all that, but also a kind of a front for intelligence, British intelligence operations, which Dr. Richard Spencer goes into in terms of, if you look up his paper that he wrote on Nicholas Rorick, Madame Blavatsky and her handlers. And I think he shows that theosophy was a really another element by which the KGB and British intelligence could have an overlap. So that's, I think, prior to what was going on with Wells or contemporary with Wells, and actually came from a higher level of the establishment than Wells, because H.G. Wells was recruited into this from the middle class. So he was really just a middle class person brought into the left wing side of the establishment in the British Empire, known as the Fabians. And they had this cloak of being sort of humanitarian and into progress and, you know, enlightenment, all this kind of stuff. So I think that Wells probably was working with what he saw as a coming trend, but they did have this planned out as a, either to have a form of scientism as a future religion or a form of new age theosophy as a future religion. That was planned out right around the same time. Yeah. Turn of the century. That's why the UN, by the way, officially adopts as its operating system philosophy, theosophy.
Mm.
If you look up the Lucis Trust and all that.
Right. And throughout, like, I mean, we really saw this like kind of manifest, and I think it took root with a lot of us between listening to you and a few other people. I began to understand this spiritual war that we were entangled in. And I'm very grateful to the work that you've done on the more spiritual side of things. And if people aren't aware of that, they really need to go check out your apologetics, because I really do appreciate what you've been doing there.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
So whenever you look at where we're at today, and you look at the secularism, you look at the World Economic Forum, you look at kind of the scientism and what's happening with it, And you draw that conclusion back through Fabianism into the Gnostic gospel, so to speak. How do you get there through the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s?
1930s, 40s, 50s, 60s?
Well, not quite the 30s. I was saying the 40s because that's when Wells was writing.
So how do I get to from Gnosticism?
Like, how did they evolve that into what we see today?
So one element that was crucial to that evolution is science fiction. And a lot of the science fiction writers of the 40s and 50s, like Asimov, for example, if you read Foundation, I think he kind of took a lot of these H.G. Wells patterns and principles. And in Foundation, he makes the future tech civilizations, future technocracy have a scientism-based religion. So there's an inner core that knows that it's all trickery of science. But then in the novel, you have this outer group that runs a religion, but it's all just scientific kind of techniques and tricks that controls a religion. There was other theorists involved with some of this international socialism, like Auguste Comte, you know, who had posited the creation of a new world religion. Brave New World has the theorizing of a new world religion that is based on Huxley's perennial philosophy, which is, again, another form of Gnosticism. So basically, it's just all the world religions blended into some kind of future religion. So I think what was going on from the time of Wells up through these decades was searching for the thing that would catch on, or that would be the ideal future religion that they could control. And one of those things that was so important to capture from this vantage point was the Vatican, because the Vatican already is kind of an existing structure that's international. And so if you could capture that institution for these purposes, then you could get perhaps an already existing model of a world government, or perhaps even move Vatican theology in the direction of perennialism, Gnosticism, theosophy. And I think you kind of begin to see that with a lot of the Vatican II documents and the natural theology that they have there, sort of capitulating to perennialism and saying, well, basically, we're all kind of arguing for the same thing under different cloaks and under different symbols. And so God is really just this amorphous superstructure thing that speaks through all the world religions. And this is kind of what you begin to see emerging. At the time, Vatican II documents like Nostra Aetate, and now with Francis, we're seeing, you know, these new synods, these new, you know, Amazon Synod, the Fratelli Tutti encyclical, the humanist synod that he wanted to propose, whatever that crazy thing was going to be that got shut down for COOF. We're beginning to see that move on to the next level, and Francis is a great example of what we're talking about, because Francis really wants to see. Sometimes he sounds like a theosophist. Sometimes he sounds like a syncretist. Sometimes he sounds like a Catholic. Sometimes he sounds like a Lutheran. And sometimes he sounds like he's promoting a new world religion. And I think that he's a great image, a great symbol of the next phase of that evolving of the Roman Catholic institution, which Brzezinski talked about in Between Two Ages. He said, let's just use Roman Catholicism as an NGO, make it a form of soft power for Americanism. Now, he's writing during the Cold War, much like Quigley and these other writers. David Wim Hof talks about during the Cold War that the CIA really wanted the Roman Catholic Institution to be a symbol and a tool during the Cold War for the projection of Americanism, which is soft power. And then now, since that institution is captured, and you see that with the pushing out of Benedict, for example, it's just time to move into the next phase. So the same masters that were behind P2 being this big Cold War symbol, now they want to move it to the next phase. So that's what's going on in the Roman Catholic world. That's the Roman Catholicism, I'm saying, is the kind of the easiest way to see an example of what you're talking about, of what's something that gets us from the 40s up to today. But other things you could point to too. I mean, the religion of the, you know, New Age thought, moving from being this weird theosophical movement promoted by the British elites to, by the time of the UN, it becoming the official philosophy of the UN, and then UNESCO essentially promoting this New Age stuff, right? The UN has a meditation room with a giant black cube in it, which is really creepy. I mean, so that's how I get from, you know, these elements. And then, of course, in the 1960s, the New Age movement explodes. And yeah, that has to, so we get, for example, the Esalen Institute. I think that's kind of the think tank behind the New Age movement in the 60s and 70s taking off. But that's another version of Gnosticism. I mean, New Age thought is just Gnostic stuff repackaged and watered down.
Yeah, no, for sure. It seems like, and you probably explain it better, which is why I asked you to talk about it, but it seems like what they're doing is they're just leveraging authority that people already recognize, and they're kind of catapulting the Gnostic kind of ideal into the propaganda.
Yeah, ecumenism is another example of it. Ecumenism has Gnostic elements to it. And the beginning of the ecumenist movement in the 1893 or 5 Parliament World Religions, where you had Swami Vivekananda showing up and saying, I'm here to create a new world religion, and Hinduism would be the basis for it. So that is kind of parallel with Blavatsky, because Blavatsky thinks Hinduism is very useful for this syncretist, you know, world religion approach. And so, yeah, I think you could look at the ecumenist movement, how that's promoted by, funded by the Rockefeller family, by their own bragging rights in their own writings. They brag about putting millions of dollars into it to get it going and make it a tool of Western geopolitical influence. And so, you know, Wim Hof has a great point in his book as to why would they want this as a extension of Americanism. And the point is that the ethos of Americanism is kind of fundamentally Gnostic itself. I mean, it comes out of the Revolution, and it's not to say that everything the Founding Fathers taught was bad or that they were all evil, but it's very influenced by several things, right? Enlightenment philosophy, not which is Gnostic, as well as biblical law, Roman common law, Italian thinkers in Italian Republic, Machiavelli, all of that goes into the influencing of the founding of the American Republic. But there is that Gnostic element there. And part of that Gnostic element ends up being the notion of everything being commodified and everything being dominated by markets. And so the Wim Hof argues that that's only going to naturally spill over to religion. So you're going to have ecumenism as the ultimate model of American religious commodification, right?
Right.
Well, a thing that you just like you can buy, purchase whatever you want your identity to be, man, woman, go pay the doctor and you can purchase that identity or just claim it. Likewise, you can just purchase or claim your religious identity, and that's ecumenism.
Yes. And it seems like that kind of on demand kind of thinking that Western.
Lucky Land Casino asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Western culture has adopted that everything's on demand. There's very little delayed gratification anymore, has led to a more Gnostic view where you can just download this material. You can just download the consciousness of the past and have all knowledge at your at your disposal to do what you want with. And so it's made it very easy for the elites to sell it like that they know better, right? Because they're able to access, that there's more access. And I don't know, maybe I was mistaken in thinking that the more access people had to pass knowledge and to reading the writings of past elites would make it harder for the current elites to have this rule and hold on to it. Mm-hmm. But it seems like in a lot of ways it makes it easier for them.
Yeah, I think that's the danger, the double-sided sword of double-edged sword of the internet technology. I mean, the internet itself is kind of a Gnostic kind of thing, because not in itself, but it gives the impression that, you know, the ease of the transference of the information through this, you know, higher dimension of the ether, you know, where the information is being transmitted wirelessly or whatever, that's how somehow like better, or that it's metaphysically superior. So it's kind of inherently got this Gnostic potentiality behind it, the way it's sold. And that ties into a lot of the promotion of transhumanism, because the idea here is that we're going to transcend our bodies. We're not going to be limited by time and space. And the whole idea of the Gnostic system is that we are limited in bodies as prison and limited by time and space as a kind of prison by some evil creator god, Yaldabaoth, right? So you can see how it blends so well with the idea of tech and internet culture and all that kind of stuff, where people just will naturally flip from, you know, being online all the time to, oh yeah, of course I want to go into the coon pod. Of course I want to have the, you know, chip in my head that allows me to access internet directly from my brain. And it's just inherently got this Gnostic selling point to it. And that's because I think if you go back to, there's a great documentary that covers this called MK Ultra, the Unabomber and the Internet. It was made in like 2003 or four, but it gets into a lot of the positivist, logical positivist, materialist thought behind the people who were speculating and talking about the releasing of the internet to the public, including some of the high-level Pentagon people who were actually hanging out at the Esalen Institute. And they sat there like, oh yeah, we're totally scientific people, engineers, blah, blah. And then they start talking about this stuff and they're like, oh yeah, because we're going to transcend our bodies. We're going to, move into this information age, which will give way to this, you know, transhumanist age. So they go from sounding like engineers and tech people to sounding like some sort of weird Gnostic occultist in the way they discuss the coming of the internet. And that makes sense because if you read Perennial Philosophy by Huxley, he says the body, so particularity is a problem. And he says that if we think about any kinds of identities that particularize, so your identity as a family, your identity as a nation, your identity as an ethnic group, your identity as, you know, whatever, white male, whatever, all of those identities, he is kind of arguing, are the problem. So the reason that men fight, the reason we have war, the reason we have disputes, and the reason we don't get along is because of the differences. When, of course, that's not the problem. The problem is man's sin, not his ontological, metaphysical existence.
Right.
Gnostic systems always attribute man's problem and evil to some metaphysical thing and not to a moral thing. So that's the commonality I see there, which is just that they want to erase all versions of identity and make it into something that you can just sort of will. I will to identify as, an attack helicopter, as B.G. Cumbie says, right? Because that means that there is no such thing as identity, or there's no particularity. There's no law of identity anymore in the Aristotelian sense. It doesn't exist. It's a social construct. So that paves the way for people to buy into the overall technocratic global brain ideology, which is what they want to bring in. Literally linking everybody into a giant global brain.
Right. And they've convinced... It's like they make it easier on themselves by manipulating the public to concern themselves so much with their own materialist standards that they're too distracted to pay any attention to what the elites are doing. And so necessarily they've secularized the public in such a way that it's almost considered a moral good to be secular and to be concerned only with the modern day.
Yeah, the deriding of the ancients, right? The deriding of perennial thought and wisdom, that's passed down, the assumption being, you know, everybody prior to what, the existence of computers was... useless and worthless, when of course it's the opposite. You know, it's the saints, divine revelation, these kinds of things are much more prescient than we are. So yeah, I would say I totally agree there.
Yeah. It's almost like, it's like this whole move with like the LGBTQ movement, or with, any of these social movements, it's all a distraction away from a higher like level of being in order to like to get the God's creation to worship the existence of modernity. And I don't know. I'm trying to tie that that Gnosticism into that. Cause I'm like, okay, I understand the goal is that if I can get you to not pay attention to the bigger picture of what the actions I'm taking, then I can actually manipulate you and build my wealth, power, and influence. But where does it help them other than just the distraction element?
Well, no, it's not a mere distraction. It's what I'm saying is that there is this emerging world religion that we're witnessing, I think, coming about pretty much now, which is what they've been kind of looking for a long time, to see what would be the thing that fits. And it looks like it's going to be something relating to, you know, what Francis and the ecumenists in Rome are up to. And that has to do with, I think, again, being a captured institution by these geopolitical powers who do have a commitment to some version of Gnosticism or Luciferianism. And so it's not merely a distraction. It is that, but you're right about that. But it's also that it's part and parcel with the plan to integrate everyone into this global brain. And so you have to get people to do this. They almost would like it to be like a new religion, like a cult. There's a great phrase in St. Gregory of Palamas where he talks about what heresies are, like Gnosticism, are ideological idols. So they're, in other words, ideology. He uses a Greek term, but he says it's a kind of logismoi that deals with delusion, but it's not like a totem pole, right? It's not an idol that you're worshiping, like, you know, the Buddha statue or whatever. It's an idol that's ideological. And that's what all heresies are. And I think that Gnosticism is one of these key ideology elements. And so they want it as an actual cult, not just a distraction. That's why I think if you look at the last 3 years, how did everybody treat science? They treated it like a religion. Trust the science was the dictum. Okay. That's a religious phrase.
Right. So. Yeah. And they wore the mask like a Christian would wear a cross.
Sacrament. Well, that and the stabbies were viewed as sacraments.
Right. Right. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I know you bring up the Vatican and that's the easiest of all to kind of dig into the Vatican. I had actually contacted Jim Jotra. So like one of the things I'm interested in is trying to figure out how the CIA bribery and buying off of Constantinople of the 40s has affected Bartholomew here recently. And you can look at, I can't remember the patriarch's name in Ukraine of the new Ukrainian church. But he was working with the CIA and Bartholomew to put this church forward. So it's not just Catholicism that's being attacked. It's all religions that are, you know, all denominations of Christianity are under attack.
Yeah. I mean, the goal here is to move them into this geopolitical subservient structure, right? And I don't know if we're in the last days or anything like that, but it's certainly the spirit of Antichrist, whether it's the actual Antichrist that's going to manifest, I don't know. But, right. You know, that movement to move everything into this sort of Tower of Babel, you know, imagery and symbology is exactly what is behind all of this. And it's ultimately just a rejection of the Logos, it's a rejection of the church. Motivated in its energy by these demonic powers. So absolutely. And, you know, the irony is that you can read a lot of high level geopolitical people like Brzezinski and Kissinger and all these kinds of figures. And you know, you could be a book nerd like me and do that, but you don't have to, because actually quite a few saints and elders of recent note said the same stuff. Like, Paisio says they're just trying to erect an Antichrist world system, and they're going to try to track and trace everybody. So try to live off the grid. I mean, he sums it up in like one paragraph, you know. So the irony being that the only people that seem to really know what's going on are the Orthodox saints and elders, and like Kissinger, Brzezinski, Rockefeller. Right. And they're if they say the same thing, then I could say that's probably what's going on.
Right. Right. Yeah. No doubt. I know Well, Brzezinski, whenever he wrote the Grand Chessboard, he had spent a lot of time writing about Ukraine.
Yep.
And about the natural gas and the resources that were available in Ukraine. So when we look at that Russia and Ukraine, we absolutely do see the geopolitical power structure or power struggle, I'm sorry. But I think we're looking at a spiritual struggle as well. When Russia is speaking out against, the World Economic Forum and their cronies going about their business around the world.
Yeah, I think the Ukraine is key. I was just reading a whole bunch on that last night. Not so much from Brzezinski. I know what you're talking about because a lot of analysts had pointed out. I think we had an article by Mark Hackard on my website that he wrote in, I think, 2015 or 16, where he was talking about what Brzezinski had written and this kind of stuff, and that Ukraine would be the coming hotspot. So he was way ahead of his time on that. And that's because he knew what Brzezinski had said in Grand Chessboard. And Brzezinski talked about it again, I think, in his later book, Strategic Vision, about the importance of Ukraine. So he'd written twice on that, but Grand Chessboard was like 98, I think. So, and then he writes again about it in 2014 or 15 in Strategic Vision. And so, I was just reading more about because I thought I had read somewhere that the Galen organization had a connection to Ukraine, but I wasn't really sure. But then I remembered I was right about that, because I'm also reading Paul Williams' book on the history of Gladio and how that was all these right-wing fascist CIA-run stay-behind units, which are the model for a lot of modern-day TERROR. And that had a lot to do with the Vatican Bank and sort of back channel funding for Cold War stuff, as well as CIA connections to the Vatican. But the reason that's such a big deal is not so much because I'm not saying, oh, that makes the communists good guys. No, it's not like that. It's like, we were watching this movie, Lives of Others, the other day, the 2006 German movie. It's really good. I highly recommend it because it's about a guy who's an East German Stasi surveillance dude in 1982 spying on this guy who's a playwright and his girlfriend who's an actress. And so they're basically just harassing and tormenting this couple because they might have anti-Stasi sentiments. So the point I'm trying to make in that analysis that I did a couple nights ago on these various books I've been reading was not that, and everybody, I don't understand, everybody misunderstands me when I talk about this, because when I start critiquing the OSS and the CIA and these Galen Otto Skorzeny networks and how that ties into the Ukraine, they start thinking, oh, so you're saying communists are good. No. I mean, my point is that if you watch Lives of Others and the nightmare evil of what the Stasi are doing, what I'm saying is that what Klaus and company want to bring in is 10 times worse than that.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
So it's not bad versus good. It's bad to even worse. That's what I'm trying to say. So I don't know why people can't understand that, but they always say, oh, you're a KGB stooge because you're critiquing what the CIA was up to in the Cold War. No, two bad guys. Two different bad guys. So, look up Stepan Bandera. Look up, General Lebed. Not General Lebed. I always get this guy's name wrong. But anyway, he's the connect to do you know what I mean by the Galen Skorzeny network? Basically, that these were the people from the Tiny Mustache Man intelligence networks that Dulles and Donovan aligned with to send to train and teach black ops, basically, to people in various countries during the Cold War. And one of those groups was to say, send to the Ukraine.
Wasn't that Operation Sunrise? If I'm not
probably
mistaken.
There's different ones. The one in Ukraine has a really weird name. I'm trying to remember what it's like. I was reading it last night, late at night. I can't remember the name of it, but basically it said, like, I'll read this article from a geopolitical analyst just real quick. He says, Stepan Bandera was living in 1946 in Munich. There he worked under protection in close collaboration with Galen, the Nazi spymaster turned CIA agent who was the future head of West German intelligence. Galen was under Nazi, was a completely unrepentant Nazi who had operated the infamous rat lines, blah, 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 blah. And then it goes on to say that Bandera and the OUN, or rather the SB, the secret police, what is who formed they formed the secret police network for Lebed, this Lebed character. And so that's the connect between Galen and in the 1950s, after parachuting 85 agents into Ukraine, the CIA concluded the project was ultimately a failure. But Lebed, who had served as the organization's foreign minister and head of the secret police, was described by U.S. Army intelligence as a sadist and German collaborator, blah, 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 blah. But so that's the connect between Lebed and the Galen network.
Yeah.
And Galen is working with the CIA in the Ukraine to set up those networks. So that's what we're seeing today, is the extension of these networks, basically. Right. So the Nazis in Ukraine, the Azov right sector, probably that's all from this stuff.
I think it's really hard for people that come at you with like those binary thoughts to get into the nuance and understand how the globalist ideology is supposed to reel in order out of the chaos that it is put forward. And
yeah, I mean, that's a thing Brzezinski talked about. He had a whole strategy called Arc of Crisis, and that was his way to destabilize all the Soviet bloc countries to integrate them into NATO and Western neoliberalism.
Right.
So yeah. I mean, he admittedly calls it and the whole Gladio model too is a model of terror and destabilization.
Yeah, Gladio is a deep subject. I still need to do an episode on Gladio at some point, because I read that book and I was just like, wait, what? it was one of those things that just kicked me in the teeth. Like, I was like, that is incredible. Like, I can't believe that. Like, yeah, I got interested in a lot of these subjects because I watched Oliver Stone's JFK when I was 12 years old.
Yeah, yeah, me too.
Right. And so it was like, all right, like I want to be a CIA hitman. That's you know. And so I started reading in on that, and that's what kind of drug me into the subject matter. And when I read Gladio, I was like, that's insane. I think Gladio in some ways is even is more evil than MK Ultra in some areas.
Yeah. I mean, when you see those connections to what they were planning and what they were up to, you know, and how it ties into even TERROR operations post Cold War, you can begin to see how, yeah, that's kind of a model for how they run a lot of these groups.
Right.
So in that sense, yeah, it could be more evil than what we know about MKUltra.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. And that's good to clarify what we know, because there's a lot we don't know. There were a lot of documents that were done away with that we're never going to have access to. And there are a lot of, when it comes to like subjects like that, there are a lot of people out there saying a lot of things, and you have to be very, very careful in digging into them, because it's like, how much of this is true? How much is
a lot of disinfo? Absolutely.
Right. Right. And
yeah, so, wading through the disinfo is like a huge, like, I mean, and I think everybody kind of goes through phases when you study this information. You know, you're going to go through anybody getting deep into this kind of information, you're going to get duped and be wrong on issues. So we always have to be ready to correct our ideas. I mean, you know, in my 20s, I was a traditional Catholic. So I just saw all of this as like, oh, it's the, you know, traditional Catholic Vatican forces versus everything else. And, you know, over time, you know, obviously I came to no longer have that view. So there's a lot more nuance, like you said, a lot more higher level strategizing and planning that's going on beyond just a simple Vatican versus Masons dialectic.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's hard to get out of there. And you do get a bad rap by a lot of people. I kind of get why, but at the same time, I'm like, yeah, but you're looking at things from a binary, and Jay's talking about things from this broad view.
Right.
It's very easy to forget that there are a lot more sides to a story.
Yep.
than what we've been fed. And a lot of people have a hard time getting around that.
Yeah.
So when we're getting into modern day and we're looking at the 21st century and we're trying to draw out some lessons from yesteryear and what we can learn from how the elites operate, how the Gnostic system has kind of weaved its way in through our system of thought. How is it that we can analyze our own objections or our own analysis of what's going on so that we can weed out this kind of Gnostic idea that's already weaved its way into our mind through propaganda?
Well, I think first thing I would think about is the idea that man's problems are a lack of knowledge. Does that really seem to be the case? I mean, we see a lot of human beings who've had a lot of knowledge in history, and they seem to still be evil. So, I mean, think about the archetype of the evil genius, right? I mean, if knowledge is man's problem, then why would there ever be an evil genius? And if you read Notes from the Underground, Dostoevsky is kind of making this point in that story that man's problem isn't just knowledge. Mm. I would say man's problem can't be the external world, because the external world isn't the problem. Yeah, we can be influenced by the external world. We can have a bad upbringing, something like that. We can be traumatized, but those things themselves can't be inherently evil, or else we would be into some kind of weird dualistic system. And I think dualistic systems are kind of self-refuting. So if it's not the world, or if it's not the body or man himself or knowledge, then what's man's problem? Well, it's got to be something spiritual. It's got to be something more than just intellect or the faculty of reasoning. So those are the things that I think to keep in mind in terms of what Gnosticism proposes, because it proposes a tech solution to man. But again, that solution is only as good as the diagnosis of the problem. So if the diagnosis of the problem is wrong, then that's not going to be a good solution. It's not going to solve the problems that it's supposedly setting out to solve. So it all depends on our paradigms and our presuppositions. But I would say that, you know, I think Orthodoxy has a much better approach to how we find healing than Silicon Valley. You know what I mean? It's like, who am I going to listen to for healing?
Yeah. Yeah. I look at the issues that we run into today, and I can't help but go back to Orwell's 1946 essay, Politics and the English Language, and see what he was complaining about in the 40s, about how the politicians attacked the English language, and they de-arm language in itself and utilize these semi-innocuous terms to bring in these tyrannical systems like the Patriot right. Act.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I need to do an episode where I'm examining that essay by Orwell alongside Edward Bernays' Propaganda.
Yeah, that'd be perfect. Yeah, I mean, the retooling of language to it can be multiple things, right? So Marx was a philologist when he was an academic. So he was really interested in this. He would spend hours a day studying about languages and terms and what they meant, how they were used. And I think we see that in the left, they've always understood the power of controlling language. And so when Orwell's writing about that, he, you know, as in 1984, it's the Fabians that are Ingsoc. Mm-hmm. And so it seems to have been a Fabian technocrat idea that they would have to ban and attack language. You see that in you call your podcast what, Year Zero, right? This is like the revolutionary Marxist idea that you can wipe out everything that came before, and that has to be applied to language. So they have to control the language, because language allows individuals to particularize.
Unfortunately for me, I found out about that after I named my podcast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I actually named my podcast because I was reading through Vault 7, and the CIA had a Year Zero program.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And I was like, yeah, that's what I'm naming my podcast. And then I was like, oh, crap.
But no, it's perfect for Great Reset, because Great Reset is a kind of Year Zero, right?
It absolutely is.
Yeah. I forgot what I was saying, but
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's all good. I mean, I think I made the point though, that part of wiping away everything that came before, like a Maoist type of thing, necessarily will involve, language, because language allows you to identify things. So one of the things that has to be destroyed is the law of identity, the Aristotelian law of identity. Because law of identity allows you to pick out and name and identify objects with their essences, their natures. And this is an attack on things having natures or essences, which is postmodernism. Everything's a social construct. To have everything be a social construct, there can't be Aristotelian laws of identity, laws of logic, laws of non-contradiction, law of excluded middle. All that has to go away. And so everything has to be a creation of your mind, which is Gnosticism.
Right. Well, man, we're running on an hour. I don't want to keep you too long. I know you got, you know, a trip to plan for and all that stuff coming up. So plug what you got to plug. Give any final thoughts on the subject at hand. And maybe we can plan another podcast. We'll get together and we'll break down that Orwell essay and compare it to Propaganda by Bernays. And
yeah, that'd be great.
Dig into that. Yeah.
If you go to the Discord, our Discord, Father Deacon Dr. Ananias, I think you could probably find it on his academia.edu page too. He has a paper on Gnosticism, technocracy, and scientism, and it's really good. I recommend that paper. It's also, I think, printed in one of the books about Let Us Not Fear Death. I think it's his essays in that book too. But that's really good for this topic. We'll be live February 11th in Austin, Texas, from 2 to 7 p.m. Right outside UT Austin. Should be a hype event. We got a lot of people there. Any haters that want to come, there's security, there's cameras, so you're not going to do anything there. And I try to be armed, so if anybody wants to.
Well, you'll be in Texas, so there'll be plenty of people that are armed.
So we're doing that. You get the tickets at the top of my Twitter. It's on my website too. Then so that's what's coming up. I think we're filming a Tucker special, so that'll be going up probably in the next few weeks as well. Nice. So I'm excited about that. And then you can just find me at my website or my channel.
Man, Tucker's going full red pill. He's had Charles Haywood, Minchus Moldbug, and Jay Dyer.
Who's Charles Haywood? I've heard of, I know who Moldbug is, but who's
Charles? That? Charles is my buddy. He does a podcast called The Worthy House. You'd really like him. He's Orthodox as well.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, okay. He does book reviews. That's nice. That's pretty much all he does. I've had him on the podcast, and he's a really good dude.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll have to look into him. Just send me his link.
I will.
All right.
All right, thanks, brother. Man. Well, I appreciate you coming on, man. You have a safe trip. I'll be praying for you, and we'll definitely get together and set something else up later on.
Awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And thanks for having me on. Sorry I was late, and thank you for your patience.
Yeah, no worries, man. You have a good one, bro.
You too. Later.
Bye.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere. This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.